The show is live and local. It is your local performance connection. And the performances we're connecting with on today's program are on Thursday, a concert by the Illinois State University Symphony Orchestra in Normal at 8 o'clock. I'll be talking with conductor Glenn Block in the second part of our show today. And first up will be the trumpeter and composer Ambrose Akinmusiri. His quintet will be featured at the Krannert Center in Urbana Saturday night in a program called The Miles Davis Experience, 1949 and 1959, a collaboration with Blue Note Records. We'll be hearing a little bit of Miles's music and also of Ambrose's music and conversation with Ambrose Akinmusiri in the first part of today's show. Hope you'll stay with us. We just heard an iconic tune by Miles Davis called So What. It's from his disc in 1959 called Kind of Blue. And that is by way of introduction to a show that's happening at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana on Saturday evening. It's called The Miles Davis Experience, 1949 to 1959. And it features a beat narrator, but more to the point for this conversation on Live and Local today, it features the Ambrose Akinmusiri Quintet. And Ambrose is the leader, obviously, as the name suggests, and also the trumpet player of the group. He's on the phone with me right now. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, man. Thanks for having me.
And giving me a mouthful to practice.
you did a good job.
In the name. Yeah, thanks very much. How did you, you're all of 29 years old, how did you get involved in this project? How did you get nominated to kind of be Miles Davis, I guess?
Well, I'll take that as a two-part question. They asked me to do it because I'm on Blue Note Records, and they came up with this tour with my record label. That's why I was focusing on from 1949 to 1959, because there's some Blue Note Records that fall within that era. So they approached me and they asked me if I wanted to do it. And at first I was a bit hesitant, just because, and this will start to answer the second part of the question, I didn't want it to be seen as Ambrose playing Miles Davis or, you know, filling in for Miles Davis. So I told them I would do it if I were able to do it the way that I would do it, or the way I would want to do it if Miles Davis himself was sitting in the audience. And that's, you know, being more improvised, you know, not knowing exactly what you're going to play in the moment, not knowing what tunes, you know, just sort of playing. And whatever comes about, you know, in tribute to him. So we're going to be playing tunes from that era, but there's also going to be some original tunes, and we're also going to just allow the tunes to develop as they would, you know, as if we were in 1949 and just playing the tunes. So we're not going to be playing the arrangements from those classic albums, but we will be playing the tunes.
So it'll be kind of like if Miles Davis was at a gig.
Exactly.
And he, you know, he's not like Miles Davis producing an album. It's Miles Davis at a gig, and he probably didn't know what was coming next.
Yeah, but even in the studio, I mean, there's those sound clips of, you know, him talking to the people in the room. He's like, I'll play it and I'll tell you about it later, you know. Now, to me, that says a lot about him. So I think he had the same approach when he went into the studio.
Actually, the way you set it up, you said, you know, you're going to do this as if Miles Davis were in the audience.
Right.
I would think imagining that would make it even more, would make it especially intimidating.
Oh, not for me. I mean, he's Miles Davis. I'm Ambrose Akinmusiri. I mean, I don't mean this in a weird way or anything, but I see everybody on the same plane. And from, you know, a 2-year-old kid to you know, Wayne Short and Herbie Hancock, we just have had different experiences, and some people have had more experiences than others. So I'm not intimidated by anyone, and I hope that nobody's intimidated by me.
Well, that's actually good to hear. I mean, I know so many people, if they see somebody who might be an idol of some kind sitting out there, it's like, oh, particularly if you're going to do any of his tunes. But if you're bringing your own voice, that's got to provide a lot of freeing up. Actually, your comment there reminded me a little bit of one of the comments that's in your biography, in which you're quoted as saying back to, who was it, saxophonist Steve Coleman, when he asked you, you know, what's your concept, man? And you said, concept? I'm 19. I don't have a concept. I don't need a concept or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
You want to talk about that a little bit? Because it does describe a little bit how you started to develop yourself.
Yeah, well, it was just, you know, no one had even, I think I was too immature to realize that I was, to admit that I was thrown off by the question. So I just had this, you know, impulse to respond with some ignorant, some type of ignorance. But, you know, from that moment, man, I really started to think about it. And I was like, man, you know, I'd been playing trumpet for like maybe 6 or 7 years. And I had never even thought about it. Nobody had even asked me, you know, what my concept was. What did I believe, you know, in music? How did I want to express myself? What did I want to express? And then it just made me realize that for the last 6, 7 years, I had been just sort of wasting my time. I mean, as an artist, you know, as a musician and technician, you know, I was doing the right things. But as an artist, you know, I think the artist is supposed to have a point of view that they let out into the world. I hadn't even begun thinking about that, you know. So from that moment on, that's what I focused on. And that still, to this day, is what I focus on, renewing that vision, or just sort of polishing that vision.
Well, you talk about how you made this list of things that you wanted for yourself, that you imagined. I mean, I guess Coleman's question prompted this, but I'm interested to know how, even at the young age that you would have been when you went into the Manhattan School of Music, that you even came up with this list of concepts. Because most people wouldn't, you know, if you asked me that question, then I don't know what I want for myself. Let my teachers tell me, or at least start telling me.
Well, you know, I just started being, it's very simple, actually. I started being honest about the things that I like and I don't like in my life. And then that started to filter into music. So, you know, Clifford Brown, I like his sound. I'm not so huge on his tonguing. So I decided to focus on his sound. Or Book a Little, I like the way he articulates stuff, but I don't necessarily like the rhythm, things like that. And so all the things that I did like, I tried to put them in my playing. And all the things I didn't like, I tried to make sure that they weren't in my playing.
You must have been a teacher's nightmare.
I was a teacher's nightmare. I mean, they all try to be cool with me now, but a lot of them thought that and probably still think that I'm very cocky and all this other stuff. But I'm not. I'm just, you know, just trying to figure out my own way.
Oh, probably now they say, oh, I taught Ambrose Akinmusiri.
Oh, man, they put me on the alumni list, and, you know, people come up to me all around the country. It's like, man, I studied with your old teacher. I'm like, really? I mean, I only have 2 or 3 people that I consider my teacher, and I doubt that you study with them.
Well, I was pleased to see that one of the things on your list was that you wanted to sound like a French horn player. That was my instrument in college, so
it's good with that. Right?
Oh, it's beautiful. Do you think, is that still a sound that you're trying to emulate?
No, not so much. It's I'm trying to get rid of the partials, the in-between notes. So I'm thinking more like a cello or a voice, you know, more everything's kind of blurred. And you know, I don't like the notes to be so slotted anymore.
To be so what?
Slotted.
Yeah, what do you mean by that?
But you know, when you play trumpet, it's like dot, 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 you know, even if you don't tongue it, you still get the effect of, you know, someone's pressing down a valve or something like that. It's still mechanical sounding.
Well, let's give a little listen to what Ambrose Akinmusiri sounds like. We heard what Miles Davis sounds like a little earlier, and this is from your brand new CD. It's almost brand new. It came out in April, called When the Heart Emerges Glistening, which is just a fantastic title.
Oh, thanks so much.
Yeah, is that, and that was your idea?
Yeah, it was my concept. Actually, to be honest, my girlfriend helped me out with it. She's a beautiful writer. Her name is Shabnam Piriyai. She's a great creative writer. And so I gave her the concept, and I sort of have like maybe 50 or 60 different, you know, words in different orders that I wanted. And she helped me iron it out into that.
And the opening track on there is called Confessions to My Unborn Daughter, which gives you a really good idea of the sound of your trumpet, I think.
Yeah, that's accurate.
And it's Ambrose Akinmusari here. He's going to be participating in the Miles Davis Experience at the Krannert Center in Urbana on Saturday evening. And you're listening to Live and Local. That was a tune called Confessions to My Unborn Daughter, composition by and performance by trumpet player Ambrose Akinmusari with a quintet of friends that you have been working with for quite a while. It was a quintet indeed in that performance?
I didn't hear your question, sorry.
Yeah, that was your the full quintet in that tune?
It was, yes. The only addition to the live band is Sam Harris on piano now. He's Gerald Clayton's no longer playing with the quintet. He's doing more of his own stuff.
And so the quintet with that alternation, is that the same group that will be at the Krannert Center on Friday or Saturday, or a different group?
Yes, no, it would be the exact same group, just with a different piano player, Sam Harris, who's a wonderful musician, one of my favorites.
And then tenor sax player Walter Smith III.
Your bassist is,
you better say the bassist's name because I'll mess it up.
Harish Raghavan.
Yeah, I would have messed it up.
It's not so hard. It's intimidating, but it's not so hard.
No, it's not hard. You just need to know which of multiple ways that I could imagine they'd pronounce it. And then the drummer's easy. It's just Justin Brown.
Justin Brown. Easy to pronounce.
How long have you been doing this show, the Miles Davis Experience?
Well, to be honest, we start tomorrow.
Oh, this is it's the opening of the whole thing this week.
Yeah, it is. So we've been ironing it out for the last 6 or 7 months, but we actually start putting it into practice tomorrow.
So why don't you tell me what you know at this point of what people can expect?
Oh, I know exactly what they can expect. What it is, it's a multimedia project. It's not a beat poet. I think they just couldn't figure out how to describe the guy. He's a narrator.
I never know what beat poet means anyway, so quoting.
It's more of an image thing, right? You think like Black Beret. Dark, smoky jazz club or something. Yeah, he's going to be narrating some biographical information about Miles, and he's going to do some readings from some poets who were around during Miles Davis's lifetime. And also there's going to be some clips from John Coltrane and Dizzy Gillespie talking about the influence of Miles Davis. There's going to be some photos, whatnot going on. And we're going to play a couple of short sets and then maybe conclude with a set of our own original music. Either way, our original music will be intertwined into this performance also, while we're playing standards and things that Miles Davis was known for during this era. Sorry.
So you've practiced enough the concept, but when you actually show up at each hall where you're going to be performing it, it'll be just that, a concept, and it'll play out differently at each performance, it sounds like.
Exactly.
Do you have an idea of kind of the long list of tunes that might show up?
I do, but I don't like to speak things. I mean, even to the band, you know, the band has been on me. You know, they've been mad at me because I haven't been giving them the list of tunes, because I feel like when you speak certain things, they become just a little bit more concrete and tangible. So I don't want to say I may play these tunes and have people expecting me to play anything, or to people to come with any type of expectations. So yes, I do know. I do have a list, but I'd rather not say them.
That's fine. Well, so what people can do is what I did. You can go look up Miles Davis records from, you know, 1949, 1959, and just see and maybe hear a little bit about what he's done, and you can get the gist of what was happening musically then, and then go listen to Ambrose Akinmusari Quintet on the new CD or even the previous one and get an idea of what they're doing. And then you might have some idea of what's going to happen at the show on Saturday night.
I think the goal, at least the goal, my goal for taking on this whole project was to introduce Miles Davis and to introduce jazz to an audience that maybe wouldn't be so, you know, quick to check it out. You know, so that means people in my generation, you know, in inner city stuff, are mainly people in my generation, and to also introduce people in an older generation to what's happening in my generation now musically. So that's why we're going to be playing the music the way we play it. I think that's important.
So what's the big deal about Miles Davis, if you had to put in a really small thumbnail sketch for somebody who wonders, you know, I know that name, but, you know, why should I listen to him? Why should I care about Miles Davis? Why is he such a big deal?
Oh, because he's the epitome of an artist. He did exactly what an artist is supposed to do. Not only did he liberate us from our ignorance, he was constantly aware of who he was at every time, and that by doing that he was able to reinvent and recreate himself, and to be at the front lines of like six or seven different movements that were completely different. So just the fact that he was able to reinvent himself so constantly and be an innovator each time is to me what Miles Davis left as his major stamp on not only music but on just being an artist. I think there's a lot of great artists out there and a lot of great innovators, but how many people innovate, you know, six, seven different things? Usually people find a certain niche, and that's what they're known for. Miles Davis reinvented himself and became, you know, and did that to the extreme each time.
What are some of the, can you talk at all about some of the specific innovations that
came
at different times?
I mean, there's fusion, you know, I can use like the terms that I don't really agree with just so people can understand, but, you know, like cool jazz and bebop, you know, and modal jazz, you know, there's so much stuff. Modern jazz, you know, with Herbie and Wayne, you know, without having Miles Davis in each one of those movements, those movements don't exist, in my opinion.
And that's Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the people that are playing right now, all the old masters that are still alive, they all came through Miles Davis. The most famous jazz musicians right now came through Miles Davis. You know, Kenny Garrett, Wayne Shorter, Sonny Rollins, Herbie Hancock. You know, the list goes on and on. And that's, I mean, there's something to be said about that.
Well, it is definitely true that if you listen to Kind of Blue, for example, the album from 1959 that we sampled just a bit ago, and then any of a number later on, if you, you know, go in every 5-year or 10-year increments, that they really aren't going to sound at all like each other.
Right, that's true.
And that's the innovation you're talking about and the reinvention that you're talking about.
Right.
It's Ambrose Akinmusiri, who is heading the quintet that will be the featured musicians in the Miles Davis Experience Saturday evening at 7:30. It's Miles Davis Experience 1949 and 1959, I should say, to be specific, along with narrator Donald E. Lacey, Jr. And let's go out with, with another of your tunes, Ambrose.
Great.
It's from your CD called When the Heart Emerges Glistening. And this is called, well, I should say this is not your tune. This is from your CD, but this is an old tune. This is your nod to tradition, I think, in that album, called What's New.
Right.
And a bit of a tribute, I understand, to the fellow trumpeter Clifford Brown.
Yeah, I just wanted to play in the style of Clifford Brown, but think about, like, what if Clifford Brown were here in 2010? You know, with the new harmonic and rhythmic things that my generation is doing. And so that's what I tried to do on that track.
Is this a little bit you're dealing with Clifford Brown the way you may deal with Miles Davis during this show?
Yeah, it's just a nod. You know, I would never, ever try to play like anybody. I don't think that I can do that.
Well, you don't need to.
Right.
You sound great yourself.
You're right.
Well, thanks very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Of course, man. You take care of yourself.
What's new? as performed by trumpeter Ambro Akinmusiri and his quintet from his new CD called When the Heart Emerges Glistening on Blue Note Records. And Blue Note Records collaborating on the Miles Davis Experience, 1949 to 1959, featuring the Ambrose Akinmusiri Quartet Saturday evening at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana. You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. Stay tuned next for a conversation with Dr. Glenn Block, who is a conductor of the Illinois State University Symphony Orchestra, giving the first concert of this academic year Thursday evening at 8 o'clock on the ISU campus in Normal. Annetta Brodsky, a deaf teen living in New York City, discovers the power of American Sign Language poetry as she prepares to be one of the first deaf poets to compete in a youth poetry slam. Our next community cinema, Deaf Jam, follows her journey. The free public screening is at the Maine Champaign Public Library Tuesday, October 4th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. The film is closed captioned and the discussion translated by a sign language interpreter. We have support today from the Music Shop, celebrating 50 years of service to music education, providing for musicians of all ages in over 200 school music programs. They also feature guitars, amplifiers, digital pianos, and sound equipment in the Pro Sound Center at 27 East Marketview Drive, Marketview Plaza, Champaign, or at themusicshop.com. We just heard Emmanuel Chabrier's wonderful work, España, which will be the opening work on a program called Viva España by the Illinois State University Symphony Orchestra on Thursday, happening at 8 o'clock at the ISU Center for the Performing Arts in Normal. The conductor of the orchestra and director of orchestras and opera at ISU, as well as professor of conducting, is Dr. Glenn Block. And he is with me on the phone right now. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So I'm curious, since this is, I assume, your first concert of this school year, right?
That's correct. This is the opening concert of the season, and we'll have six large cycles and programs of opera and oratorio and regular symphony programs for the season.
So what are the particular challenges of meeting with the orchestra in, what, maybe end of August and having to prepare a concert in this short period of time, especially since it is the first time working with, I think, a lot of the students, since you will certainly have freshmen and new graduate students and so on?
We face that as all university orchestras, and I think even secondary school orchestras do. It's just a preparing process of just getting everybody acclimated into the technique and to the sight reading. We're really very blessed by a larger pool of players that we've been noticing at Illinois State. The enrollments at the university in general and in the School of Music have grown, so our pool of players in the orchestra has again, really grown by a byproduct of that. And we're now over 90 players, and so it's a different sense of an orchestra that's basically playing like a full-time professional orchestra. They come in with so much preparation. So it's been easier this year with the higher level of playing.
Do you have graduate students in the orchestra?
Yes. It's a wide range of freshmen that are coming in as music majors. There are freshmen who are non-music majors that are really wonderfully talented and want to continue and have this opportunity to be in the orchestra, all the way through advanced graduate students finishing masters in performance and in education. So it's a really full gamut and a widespread group of levels. And I think we just set the bar at the very highest level, and everybody just continues to aspire to that level.
Do you, in programming for the season, do you feel that you need to put an easier level of music on the first concert, or not necessarily, just to get people acclimated?
Not even a consideration. I think we can now choose, again, a really wide gamut of professional level repertoire. And I don't think this program is less demanding. It's actually even more virtuosic than some standard symphonies, where we're basically featuring pieces that are renowned in the repertoire for being the most difficult of solos. The Rimsky-Korsakov Capriccio Espanol has a wide range of the most virtuosic of solos that are on auditions for the top professional orchestras, and so we are doing that level of repertoire.
So you've given away one of the other pieces that's on the program. As I said, it's a program you're calling Viva España and has Chabrier's piece of that name. And almost all the rest of it has a Spanish influence, including a piece that hardly gets played anymore for some reason or another by Manuel de Falla called Nights in the Gardens of Spain. You want to talk about that a little bit, and why doesn't it show up on programs very often?
It's really wonderful piano concerto, but it's not necessarily a piano concerto in the traditional style of being an exhibition of virtuosic display. The de Falla style comes from his studies in France and with Debussy, and so we hear basically a Spaniard writing Spanish music, Spanish-sounding music, but with this sort of mood that's evoked of Debussy and a really gorgeous local of Impressionism. And so the colors that come out of this concerto don't necessarily seem to be a display of the pianist and his or her technique, but what is sort of about the piece, just evoking these great moods. So my sense, why we don't seem to hear this piece played very often, is that I think pianists want a different vehicle when they have an opportunity to be with an orchestra. And I basically was the one that initiated asking one of our new piano faculty members to be a soloist with this piece that he had never studied or had just only known about. And I think that's probably the way this piece works. I think there's some Spanish pianists that will carry a piece like this and offer it to orchestras, and maybe in a particular program like ours where we're featuring Spanish music, somebody might select it. I love the piece. I've known and conducted the piece several times, and I remember playing it when I was a young performer in orchestras. And the mood just evokes these gorgeous nights. I've toured orchestras and brought orchestras to Spain, and I have walked some of these places that De Falla writes about, at the Generalife or the Alhambra, and I've walked in those gardens at night, and there's something about the wonderful aroma of these flowers that are really unique to Spain, and you see these gorgeous vistas of the sun going down and the purple skies having a color that you just don't see, and all of those elements combine in the sounds of what De Falla wanted to portray. And I think the piece is incredibly effective and incredibly impressive.
So who is the new faculty member who'll be playing it with you?
Joshua Russell is our new faculty member. He's been on faculty at Bradley and Bradley University in Peoria, and has joined us this last season. Also frequently performs in Central America and has a very strong ties to Haiti and programs down there.
Well, let's give a listen to the opening of Manuel de Falla's Nights in the Gardens of Spain, and that's N-I-G-H-T-S. There's not a K in front of that. It occurred to me somebody could think of something else there. Joshua Russell will be the piano soloist with the ISU Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Glenn Block, who is my guest on Live and Local right now, and the concert will be on Thursday at 8 o'clock at the ISU Center for the Performing Arts. Thank you. We heard some of the opening of Manuel de Falla's Nights in the Gardens of Spain here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. And I'm talking with Glenn Block, who will be conducting that work on the ISU Symphony Orchestra concert on Thursday, featuring pianist Joshua Russell. And then you mentioned earlier Rimsky-Korsakov's Capriccio Espanol, which is a wonderfully fun piece of music to listen to, and I think for students to play. And then you have the piece that, if there's a Spanish connection, I don't know about it, by Franz Liszt. You want to talk about that one a little bit?
Yes, we're doing the Late Prelude, which is the third of the symphonic poems that Liszt had written during his career. It's, I think, a signature piece in music history because it's the very first symphonic poem, a piece that is composed to tell a story, and there are actually several versions of the genesis of how this piece got written. We're performing it on a Spanish program just because it's an opportunity for us to help celebrate the 200th anniversary of Liszt's birth. And so Liszt compositions are being featured on orchestral seasons all over. And the piece as a Late Prelude also speaks to the sort of a metaphysical journey that each of us takes through life. And for Liszt, he wanted to imagine, as he describes it in a very specific poem, that life was just a series of preludes to death, and that each of us undertakes a journey of various loves and experiences. And in the piece, he's taking us on this journey. There are sections that are for sure about nature and the colors that he evokes. There are for sure sections that are about love and about being more sentimental. There is an opening section that comes back at the very end that has been featured in all kinds of cartoon music, sort of showing a certain warrior and strength that each of us have to sort of deep down in our hearts and souls when we face adversity. And somehow this piece works on all of those emotional levels. And so I thought, certainly to put it on the beginning of a season's opening concert, I thought was appropriate. I know that I was on a faculty member at the Interlaken National Music Camp for six seasons and on the staff of the Interlaken Arts Academy Orchestra for two seasons. And every season at Interlaken has famously ended with a monster production of a Late Prelude as a fitting end to the summer season and a certain acknowledgement that each of those young students that would experience an Interlaken music experience would move on as if that was a sort of a prelude summer to the rest of their life, many choosing to go into music by those experiences at Interlaken. So for me, the Late Prelude has had a certain connection that way.
This is actually another piece that used to show up on professional orchestra programs much more than it does anymore. At least that's how it has seemed to me. Any idea why this one has been, I think, kind of neglected in recent years? Because it's a wonderful piece.
It is, and that's a good question. I certainly don't have an answer, but I think coincidentally, as I've been sort of surfing YouTube situations and live concerts on some of the TV channels that feature concerts from Europe, I'm seeing various Late Prelude live from Berlin and from France with various major conductors and orchestras. And so I certainly think that people are looking at the Liszt repertoire this season because of the anniversary. And again, there will be another opportunity for people who don't know that composer or know his work to sort of see another dimension of the repertoire that doesn't get featured very often.
Well, I think the pieces that of his that get played most often for orchestra are the piano concertos.
I think that's true.
And then lots of
and
solo
are
piano
more,
music.
More virtuosic in what we were referencing when we were talking about the de Falla.
Sure.
They certainly are. As Liszt was a piano virtuoso, he was able to write for certain level of pianist, and I think you have to have the physical stamina, the physical ability to play those large leaps and the large chords that he has built with his own repertoire and his own ability in mind.
You're closing the program, Glenn, with a piece that I've heard, but I'm not positive that I've heard for orchestra, although I probably have. It seems to me it exists in arrangements for different kinds of instruments by a fellow named Jaime Texador. Talk about that one a little bit. That's sort of like your pre-programmed encore.
That's pretty close to where it will be on the program. It's going to be the last piece on the program. It's a very rousing Spanish march. It's not written specifically for orchestra. I've sort of arranged and adapted the wind band parts to be able to be played by violins and violas and the strings. I've used that when I took an orchestra to Spain in 1992 for the Expo World's Fair. We were the featured orchestra representing the United States. And we closed every program with this wonderful march. Somebody had suggested it to me at the time. I did not know the march existed. And while we were in Spain, as we would close each program with this rousing march, they would sort of clap along the way people sort of clap along in our country with Sousa marches during the summer, or the way the Viennese do for those Strauss-Radetzky marches. There's a way that they're brought into the enthusiasm of what those marches are able to display. And so the Texador is a wonderful closing march.
It's called Amparito Roca, named after a former student of his?
That's exactly right. I thought there would be something more interesting about it, but it was just an acknowledgement of a music student that was ultimately going to go into music, and it was just basically the boy's name.
Well, there you go. It would be nice to inspire great marches like that if you were a young person. And now Amparito Roca, wherever he may be, if anywhere, has been immortalized.
It's true.
It's the march that will close out the concert on Thursday by the Illinois State University Symphony Orchestra. It starts at 8 o'clock at the ISU Center for the Performing Arts on the ISU campus in Normal. The program is called Viva España, and it will be conducted by Director of Orchestras and Opera at ISU, Dr. Glenn Block. Glenn, have a great concert, and thanks very much for joining us on the show. You're listening to Rimsky-Korsakov's Capriccio Español, is performed by members of the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Luis Biava. Here are a number of other events you can go out and see and hear live besides the ISU Symphony Orchestra Thursday night. The Pacifica Quartet is opening its Beethoven cycle of string quartets that will happen throughout the year. Tonight's first concert is at 7:30 at the Krannert Center in Urbana. There's a faculty recital on the ISU campus in Normal at Kemp Recital Hall featuring trombonist Mark Babbitt. That's at 8 o'clock tonight. A group called Ha Ha Tonka is at the Castle Theater in Bloomington tonight at 8 o'clock. The Parkland Early Jazz Ensemble is at Boomerang's Bar and Grill in Urbana this evening at 7. Violinist Stefan Milenkovic and pianist Rohan da Silva perform a recital at the Krannert Center in Urbana tomorrow evening at 7:30. The U of I New Music Ensemble is at the Krannert Center also tomorrow evening at 7:30. Maurice McKinley is with Katie Flynn playing jazz at Jim Gould's Restaurant in Champaign tomorrow evening at 6. It's the Clark Gibson Quintet at the Iron Post in Urbana tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. Parkland Theater opens Tennessee at 100, a series of one-act plays by Tennessee Williams, tomorrow evening at 7:30. Oboist John Dee, horn player Thomas Justlein, and pianist Jennifer Garrett give a program at the Mills Breast Cancer Institute on the main Carl Clinic campus in Urbana. It's a free program for about 45 minutes to an hour, Thursday at noon. You're listening to 90.9 WYL FM and HT Urbana with translators W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville, NPR and Classical Music for Central Illinois. WYL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois, and we have support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the series collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com.